What do you call your sister's husband's brother?
What exactly is a word fugitive?
And does English really have no word for someone who's alive?
Today we're filling lexical gaps by discussing the words English doesn't have on this episode of Non-Existent Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are talking about lexical gaps and words that English doesn't have. So, end of episode. Have a great week.
It's going to be tricky, isn't it? Trying to do an entire episode that's just about words that don't exist.
Words that don't exist.
That is what we're going to attempt, because normally we talk about the rich vocabulary of English. But today we're kind of exposing English's weaknesses, where it doesn't have terms for certain things.
Yeah, we're going to talk about lexical gaps and accidental gaps, and we're going to talk about words that other languages have that we don't.
Hey, hold on. Lexical gaps, accidental gaps, jargon. Help us. What does it mean?
So a lexical gap or an accidental gap is when a word could or even seems like it should exist because grammar allows for it and the words and sound patterns exist, but we just don't for various reasons. And there are a lot of different reasons, which is really fun.
So we have all of the ingredients to make this word, but for some reason it doesn't exist.
This can be sound-based, meaning-based. There are a bunch of different variations, but a really simple sound-based gap would be that we have words that begin with spr, like spring or spread, and we have words that end with ick, like sick or flick. So we could have the word sprick, but we don't.
But that's basically a niche that can be filled, right? So we have sprick. What are we going to apply it to? I mean, it sounds like it should be something pointy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Whatever it is, it needs to be pointy.
Maybe it's like a spring stick.
Yeah, a springy stick. Yeah. Maybe one of those things that you used to throw a tennis ball for a dog.
Oh, yeah. Those are fun.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. The only word I have for that is chuck it, which I'm pretty sure is a brand name.
Oh, there you go. Now, well, yeah, we talked about this, haven't we? Yeah, it could have been in the future, we'd all be saying, did you know that a chuck it was originally a brand name? But no, sprick it is. Well done, us. Gosh, we've invented a word.
We also have these meaning-based gaps too, right? Like, so concepts that exist within our realm of experience, we don't have words for them. And a big one, I'd say, in terms of things that many people have, is words for different family members that we just don't have a word for. Like your niece or your nephew, we don't have a gender-neutral version of that word. So people have made up a neologism, nibbling, to fill that gap, right? So this is one of the fun things about lexical gaps is you get new words out of them too.
Yeah, so neologism literally does mean new word. I mean, the etymology of that is new word. Yeah, so you nibblings, there's pibblings. I can never keep up with all of these. None of them really catch on. Like, so we don't have this term, a collective term for your aunts and uncles. Some people say nuncle, which is awful.
That's very Shakespearean, right?
Sorry. Yes, my nuncle. You know what I want a word for? I want a word for my sister's husband's family. Now, I know they're sort of technically a kind of in-law, but it doesn't really work for me, right? My brother-in-law's brother should therefore also be my brother-in-law, but that can't be right,
can it?
I mean, I barely met them. Yeah, exactly. Sort of in-laws. We need a term for that. You know, a language that's got a lot of these terms is Korean.
Oh.
Korean is really good at nailing down the specifics of family members. For example, they do have separate words for your older brother and younger brother and older sister and younger sister.
And we just have too many syllables for that, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, we require a minimum of two words to do it, which, it could be better. It's a lexical gap.
Maybe your additional in-laws could be your outlaws.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, you've got the in-laws, the more distant ones are the outlaws. And then you've got the yonder laws. You never even met.
Hither laws.
The hither laws, the thither laws, and the yonder laws.
You also get lexical gaps around emotions, right? So we have a lot of emotion words in English. We've got fear and anger and joy and sadness and even ambivalence and things like that. But ambivalence is a relatively recent coinage from psychology. We don't really have single common words for some mixed emotions, like happy, regret, and anxious excitement. And I mean, I guess you could say, you know, buzzing with anticipation and things like that. There are ways to say it, but a single word that encompasses that energy, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time we turn to German to solve these problems, don't we? Because
yes. They seem so, I mean, it compounds.
Yeah, I mean, we all know about Schadenfreude, right? This word that I think you can fairly safely say that it is an English word now, in that, you know, you can use it now and it's not necessarily conspicuous as, you know, switching to the German language when you do it. And that's the idea of taking pleasure in someone else's pain, Schadenfreude.
My favorite community joke of all time. Have you seen the show Community?
Oh, yeah, I have.
There's a German character who says, I wish there was a word for taking pleasure at someone else's misfortune.
That's funny. Yeah, I do like that. I do like that. They also have that, I think along the same sort of lines, there's Fremdscham, which is feeling someone else's shame.
That's nice.
Yeah, but there are lots of these. And I will, seeing as I'm speaking to you from Germany, I'll just talk to you through some of my favorite German words that we don't have. I mean, these are all a product of the fact that German just puts words together differently. We would put spaces. German doesn't put the spaces in. But there are rules you have to obey to create these long compound words, but really there's no limit to them. Like a German dictionary is theoretically an infinite document, right? Because right now we could coin a German word if we were smart enough. No problem. We could confidently say a word that has never been said before, but is not, you know, if we did that with English, then no one would understand it. So there's one that, some of these are quite well known if you're into your words and stuff. Kummerspeck. You aware of this one? It's not actually a feeling, but it's the result of a feeling. Well, it gets translated as grief bacon, although I think it's more like grief fat would be a better way of translating Kummerspeck. And it's the weight you put on from comfort eating.
Right,
so you've been through a bacon, you say, oh, you know, you put on a bit of weight. Yeah, it's just a bit of Kummerspeck. Yeah. Oh, and everyone will feel terribly sorry for you, which is, it's good to have a name for that rather than saying, yeah, I really piled on the pound since she left me. A really vivid term is Torschlusspanik. Have you heard of this one?
No, but something panic.
Correct. Yeah. The end is panic, and Torschluss is gate closure or door closure. It goes back to medieval times, right? When the gates of the city would literally be closed at a certain time at night.
Oh no. And so you got to get through before.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the original Torschlusspanik would be the panic you feel if you think, I'm not going to get back into the city before night. I'm going to have to spend the night outside of the city walls. I'm going to get assaulted by a highwayman.
That dovetails beautifully with the origin of the word panic, which basically it's from the god Pan of the wilderness. So like the notion that you're trapped outside with the wilderness.
I tell you what, they do like their classics in Germany. It might not be a coincidence that it works out like that. In modern day German, Torschlusspanik is the anxiety that time is running out to achieve life goals. So, you know, the doors of life are starting to close, sort of in danger of slamming shut. You know, it gets talked about a lot when it comes to, you know, having children before you're too old to do it, or you know, not finding the love of your life before you're too old to appreciate it, if such a thing is possible. But, you know, it might be more banal than that, but there's this idea of Torschlusspanik. Time is running out and it's just this sort of niggling anxiety, or maybe overwhelming anxiety.
I think the closest equivalent we have is way more specific, and that's probably like your biological clock. And again, that's two words.
But it, I mean, and that is more specific, and it is two words, but it's definitely getting to the same idea, right? But it also, I do like this sort of medieval walled city origin of the
It's very evocative. It's great. Yeah. And that also, that's kind of neat because it's a hybrid word, right? And a hybrid word is made up of components from two different language families. Right. It has been considered in English to be bad form to combine Latin, Greek endings with Germanic words in the past, but we have loads of them too, like harpist and intertwine and forefront.
And it will necessarily happen in German just through the way that you build compounds. I mean, if you know, if the word exists as a legit noun in German, then it can easily find itself in a compound with any other Germanic adjectives, for example, as well. I mean, yeah, it's not a faux pas to create one of those.
This reminds me of, what are they, what's the word for it? It's phonosemantic matching. This is a little bit in the weeds, but like very briefly and very simply.
We like
it's
the weeds, Jess. We like the weeds. It's okay.
It's when a word gets ported over into another language to create a neologism, and then the non-native sounding elements of the word are altered to make it sound like it's not a foreign word. And this has some overlap with folk etymology, which we talk about a lot. Like the word outrage is not from the words out and rage, but it's from the French ultrage, which is from the Latin ultraticum, and it means extraness, but we interpreted it as a compound word in English and respelled it that way. A couple other good examples would be words for animals and plants that we get from Native American words, like the muskrat was from a word that was more like musquash or something like that, and persimmon was more like passiminen, and both of those are Native American words that now look very Germanic or Latin derived.
Cockroach is one that we always come back to as well, isn't it? Cucaracha, right? Let's just assimilate that into our language by using two existing words in our language, even though it's got nothing to do with fish or cocks.
Right.
There must be occasions. I can't think of one off the top of my head. I don't know if you can. Where a word has been borrowed from English. It has been changed in another language to fit that language. And then we've borrowed it back from them because it's now sexy and exotic. Oh, go on.
Okay, well, it's the other way around. Okay, so artichoke. Artichoke moved from Arabic to Spanish to Italian to English, and then the word was eventually phonosemantically matched back into colloquial Levantine Arabic in Syria and Lebanon as artishuki, which means earthy, thorny, which is really cool, wow. Right?
Yeah. This is all sort of wrapped up with boomerang words. But so if you combine those two things, you get this sort of ultimate boomerang, right? Not really.
Yeah, we have a lot of overlap between like hardcore linguistic terminology and then like the more fun etymology terms that we use.
I'm going to keep my eye out for one of those. I bet Japanese has taken a word, an English word, has made it something strange and then sent it back to us. Like, you know, the end of karaoke is from the Japanese assimilated version of orchestra is orchestra. OKE at the start of that is the OKE at the end of the empty orchestra that is karaoke. And we've taken that back. So that's almost there. We're almost there with that one, actually. Can I mention another German feeling?
Yeah.
So we have homesickness, which is the feeling you have when you're away and you would rather be at home. But the German, as well as Wanderlust, which is a term that we have taken from German already for a desire to sort of get out and about. In German, it means to be out in the hills quite sort of specifically. To be out, das Wandern is hiking, basically. But they also have this term Fernweh, which literally means far pain. Das tut weh means it hurts, right? That's the idea of it's a yearning to travel, right? To be far away. And there are, I think, a few of these in other languages, this sort of whole area. There are words in other languages, like French has dépaysé, right? Which means to be discountried. It's the feeling you get when you are not at home, right? And it's not quite the same as homesickness. It's more just sort of feeling a bit strange being somewhere else. And there's this particularly beautiful Welsh word that I need to mention. It's hiraeth. I don't know if you've heard this one. It's a beautiful one. It's usually only really used in the context of Welsh people yearning for Wales when they're not there. But it's actually got a much broader meaning in Welsh and in use by English-speaking Welsh people to mean really a yearning for anything that's absent, so a person that's absent, a thing that's absent. You feel hiraeth for their absence, right? It's really beautiful. And I don't think we have a single word for that. We do have homesickness. We do have nostalgia. We do have just missing someone. But we don't have a word that encompasses all of those.
Nostalgia originally was a translation of Heimweh into Latin and Greek by a Swiss medical student who wrote a dissertation about a condition that was thought to be common to Swiss soldiers and mercenaries who were fighting in other parts of Europe. It was called the Swiss disease for a while because apparently they thought only what it probably was PTSD and things like that.
Yeah, which also gets renamed as, gets called shell shock in England.
That's cool too, because that study happened in the 1600s before most people were taking depression and PTSD and the causes of war seriously.
That's interesting. So they called it Heimweh, right, which is literally home sickness. It is the flip side of the Fernweh coin.
And nostalgia means homecoming grief from Latinized Greek words, which is a little bit neat. The reason it changed is because in a medical journal from the 1830s, it said that the symptoms of nostalgia arise in people when they're seized with a longing desire of returning to their home and friends and the scenes of their youth, which is how it kind of moved from medical diagnosis to popular culture, you know, things that make you remember that time when you were a kid.
Nostalgia sounds so clinical. It sounds like a disease, but I've never thought of it as one.
It's much sadder in origin than marketing uses it today.
Yeah, than like radio stations that play 50s music.
Right, not quite the same. But you still get that sort of little like gut tug, you know?
Do you know that Finnish has got a word for drinking alone at home in your underpants with no intention of going out?
I have heard this before. I think I encountered it on like an Instagram post or something like that.
Yeah, it's been a bit sort of meme-y in recent years. It's kalsarikanit. It tends to get translated into English as pants drunk. Yeah, and it is the idea of drinking at home in your underwear with no intention of going out. Actually, in 2023, so the word must have been doing the rounds, in an episode of The Simpsons, Homer claims to have been doing it before it was fashionable.
That's, again, very evocative.
Yeah. Another popular one to point out is that the Swedish lagom means just the right amount. Mm. So it's not like adequate. Adequate, there's a negativity to an adequate, isn't there?
Yeah, it's
not. It's not. It's just. It's not. So the idea of lagom, which I'm definitely pronouncing slightly badly.
This is like Goldilocks.
It's the Goldilocks zone. Yes, it's mm-hmm. ideal as well as just the right amount, if you know what I mean, whereas adequate is sufficient. Right. Point is, I'm struggling to explain it because we don't have a spot on, alternative for that. So that word hygge, you know, the Danish hygge, it describes, the word I want to use is coziness, but they'll tell you it means much more than that. But it's the idea of, you know, it being cold outside, you're indoors with a roaring fire with all your friends, the drink is flowing and the good times are rolling. That is
it's like the most cozy.
Hygge, an idea that supposedly the Danes have and none of the rest of us do.
I like it. You know what? I'll allow you to claim that. I wish I aspire to Danish coziness.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. They know, the Scandinavians, they know how to get cozy. There are also words that English has had in the past that we don't have anymore. You know, often when we talk about words that were in Old English, it's like there's only ever been one sort of citation of it. And I don't know how many citations there were of this one, but you know, uchtkere, dawn sorrow. So it's the feeling of sort of dread or sadness that comes before sunrise. But really, it just comes from, as far as I know, someone could correct me if I'm wrong, it just comes from a single poem called The Wife's Lament, where a woman is lying in bed, sort of wondering where her husband is. He's been exiled, but she's gone with him, but somehow managed to lose track of him. So she's lying in bed filled with this sort of dawn care, uchtkere.
We did a spooky words episode at one point, and we mentioned that Old English had a lot more words for witches than it does currently. Like lubestra meant like poisoner, and they are similarly from like a single or one or two sources, and it tends to be like these are terrible people and things like that. But then it also had a geldorkraft again, I believe, which was something about, I think, an enchantress or something along those lines. So there were like 5 or 6 different kinds of witches, and now we just have kind of the one witch, or, you know, maybe sorceress implies something slightly different.
Yeah, there are nuances to them, but they serve our purposes, don't they? There's also this old English word, hraðvirda. It means speaking too fast, as in, you know, speaking before you've thought. I'm not convinced we've got a word for someone who is quicker to speak than to think.
I could use that word. It seems pertinent.
I don't know what you're talking about, Jess.
Sure.
And there's this word "grok" as well, which is a
grok.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I would say it's dialect, so it's in use in some places, I think. But it's to stare at someone's food in the hope that they'll give you some. The sort of thing that I imagine occasionally one of your lovely doggies
is
guilty of.
All of them at once, as a matter of fact.
There you go. I can well imagine it.
I was thinking it might be nice to talk about why these happen, the different kinds of gaps that you don't necessarily think about in English.
Because there are reasons that we don't have these words, right? It's not just that necessarily that we just haven't thought to.
One of the reasons is that we are a Germanic language that also has a lot of influence from French and Latin and some Greek introduced at different points. So like endings, we have multiple noun-forming endings that you can attach to a verb, like recital or recitation. We can use both of those words, right? But we don't use arrival and arrivation as much. And we might use proposal or proposition, but we might not use refusal and refusation. It just doesn't sound like a word. And like approval we have, but we might not have approbation, but we have the assimilated form approbation because we just yoinked the Latin word wholesale with the T-I-O-N on it. So the V has turned to a B because that's how you would do it in Latin.
It's the explanation for these sort of where there's three options, but for some reason we've only got two of them. Is it that we have borrowed this one and this one, but we just haven't bothered to borrow that one, and that's why we don't have it, rather than as not having constructed, you know, the other two from this one? I'm doing finger gestures that are very helpful for people watching, but not terribly helpful for anyone listening. In fact, I'm not even sure they're that helpful to the people watching.
Emotionally useful. But anyway, yes, you're getting at it. A lot of these happen, especially with the T-I-O-N ending, because of back formations and the way that we create back formations, which we've talked about before, like escalate is a back formation of escalator. But many Latin-derived nouns that end in T-I-O-N, like elevation, were adopted directly into English from French, and only later did we make them into verbs, making it seem as if there were English verbs corresponding to these fancy Latin-French nouns all along. So evaluate, regurgitate, exploit, and destruct entered English after evaluation, regurgitation, exploitation, and destruction. And we've got words like, I think we've mentioned this one before, but resurrection was adopted into English from Old French in the 1300s, but the verb form resurrect isn't recorded until 400 years later. And in fact, as recently as the early 1900s, resurrect was considered to be incorrect because the Latin root verb of resurrect is resurgere. So if you're being prescriptive about Latin forming word patterns, the verb form of resurrection should be resurge. Oh. But we also have that word, so we made resurrect instead, which is really fun. You get these, like, this explains why we have an inconsistency about it. And one of the reasons here is English has about three times as many nouns as verbs, and so does French. Eventually, though, we got around to making specific verbs corresponding to these nouns. We invent words this way all the time. And Shakespeare did it all the time too. That's how he invented some of his words, right? One of my favorites though is destroy and destruct. We have both of them, right? And they mean kind of the same thing, but also not. Destroy is ultimately from the Latin destruere, meaning to tear down or demolish, which literally means to unbuild. Destruere is also the root of structure, construct, obstruct, things like that. So why does destroy have a different ending than obstruct, destruction, obstruction, things like that? Why is destruct less common in some contexts than destroy? Like, we say we destroy something and we destruct something sounds wrong, right? So destroy is by far the oldest word among the ones that I just listed: structure, construct, obstruct, destruction, etc. And it came to English in the 1200s with the Norman French spelling. So As is usually the case, the nouns, destruction, obstruction, and construction entered English first, and the verbs came later. They all share this base root, but because English adopted the nouns first, we hung onto that struct part when creating the English verbs for construct and obstruct and words like that. Now, the verb destruct is a back formation of destruction, but because we already had destroy, we usually say we destroyed something rather than we destructed it. And in fact, destruct didn't appear in English as a verb until 1958.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you haven't even mentioned deconstructed, by the way.
Right. Which is a whole thing. By the way, the phrase self-destruct, which we use more frequently than destruct as like a plain verb, didn't show up until 1966 in the voiceover at the beginning of the TV show Mission Impossible.
No, you mean this message was self-destruct? Is the what, the coining of the word self-destruct?
Self-destruct, that's right.
No!
Yes!
That's it's very
fun.
Magnificent.
But there's so much fun. The other thing that happens, like, back formations can also happen with other parts of speech, like the verb sulk is a back formation of the adjective sulky. The adjective grandiloquent is a back formation of the noun grandiloquence. And then lazy is older than laze. Hesitation is older than hesitate. And editor, as we've talked about before, is older than edit. And I also like that you can make funny back formations, like before math, the situation before a significant event was a joke from Collier's in 1911. But what about the aftermath? Inquired Mr. Wilson. Oh, said Milvor with a shrug. We haven't got anything to do with that. There's bound to be an aftermath. We'll do our part if we can avoid a before math.
I've got a couple of these actually, because in Indian English, you can prepone something as well as postpone it, right?
That's
to move something forward. And that's perfectly legit word from Indian English. People do use it. I've heard it. It happens.
It makes perfect sense.
Well, one that we do use quite a lot, though, is underwhelm. Actually, overwhelm is a word, right? To whelm is to flip something over. To overwhelm something is to do that with great gusto. But if you know that whelming means turning something over, the idea of underwhelming something doesn't really make sense, right? We've invented underwhelm just as an opposites to overwhelm, but not to the sort of original meaning of overwhelm, to a figurative, extracted, transferred meaning of overwhelm, which is to astonish or what have you. Yeah. I mentioned this in a recent video of mine, by the way, if anyone thinks they're getting déjà vu, which is also a term that we didn't have an English word for. So we had to borrow one.
These are like unpaired words, right? That don't have they're also called sometimes last positives or orphan negatives, which we've addressed before, but they're very fun. Like we have exuberant, but not uberant.
Yeah. Nonchalant, not chalant.
We have improvise and provision, but not provise as a verb. That's kind of a fun one. We have ineffable, but not effable. We just say eff it about effable. But those are fun.
Gormless is a favorite one of mine. I like
yeah,
gormless.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because gorm was like paying attention, right? So you would, niman gorm was the old English, which means take gorm, which means, you know, to pay attention to something. So if you're gormless, you're not, you're inattentive.
Ah, interesting. It's kind
yeah,
of the...
So to be gormful would be, to be full of gorm would be to be paying an awful lot of attention.
Another fun one, I think, is wistful and wist. Wist is an archaic term meaning to know from the Old English witan, I believe, of the same meaning. It came to be associated with bittersweet and melancholy or nostalgia, actually, through middle and early modern English term had I wist or had he wist, which was a noun meaning regret for a rash action, especially in the turn of phrase had I wist cometh ever too late, meaning essentially regret for the knowledge or the rashness of your actions always comes too late.
So to relink this to our sort of general theme of words that we don't have but could have, you do have these words that have these prefixes or suffixes that could be swapped out for another prefix or suffix, but for some reason we don't choose to do it.
One of the main reasons too, especially with adjectives, is where you see it a lot, is we try to stick to Germanic suffix on Germanic root. Again, there are lots of what's the word I'm looking for?
Exceptions.
Things that break the rules. Exceptions. There we go. I write words, books about words and things, you know, anyway.
You do words good normally.
I do the words good. Anyway, I'm sounding a little dorkity here, and we can't say dorkity because dork is because we say dorkiness instead, because that's one of those Germanic endings that we put on a Germanic word. Same thing like darkness instead of darkity, or kindness instead of kindity, or you also, there are other endings here, like you can say stupidity, but we don't say stupidity, or, you know, we'll say width or wideness, but not widety as much. And
you'd say stupidness. Would you say stupidness? But stupidness sounds a bit odd. And maybe it sounds odd because you are getting this French word and sticking a Germanic suffix on the end of it.
Stupidity sounds better. It rolls off the tongue.
Your stupid ship.
One funny thing is we have these verb and agent noun gaps too. So English often adds ER to verbs to mean someone who does X, right? Teach, teacher, drive, driver, write, writer. But we have some that we just don't use. Like we don't say stealer for someone who steals, we say...
Or liver for someone who lives, right? Because that's already an organ.
Right.
So we don't go. So English doesn't like, if you discount liver, because who the heck says liver to refer to someone who's alive? That is a proper lexical gap. We don't have a word for just a person who is alive.
A person who's alive.
Do we? I can't think of one. No, a mortal, that just means someone who will die. That's
right.
Not the same thing. Yeah.
Person who exists. Being, maybe, but that's the closest we've got.
Yeah, but you could have. Could you have a dead being?
You're definitely not being. Or you're morbid. Being dead.
You are being dead. Being is close. Being is close. All right.
We're getting into philosophy, Rob.
So when we find these gaps in our language, concepts for which we don't have a term, we've got a few options, haven't we? We can borrow a word from another language, or we can invent one. And there are all sorts of ways in which we can do that. Tell us about a few of these, because there are some funny invented words around there.
Well, the easiest way to fill a lexical gap, and this can also just fill a gap for a word you don't know or can't think of in the moment, would be thingamajig, what's it, doohickey. And these are placeholder names or dummy words or fillers, though they're different from and like, which are also called filler words. They're also sometimes called cadigans, but no one knows where that word came from. So
hold on. That's funny, isn't it? Right. So that someone has made up a word for this type of made up word.
Yes.
Because there's a lexical gap around what you call a thingamajig, a thingamibob, a doohickey, a what's it?
The nice thing about cadigans too, though, is they can also cover words that we kind of do have. So for example, the generic names John Doe and Jane Doe are placeholder names. They're also cadigans because they take the place of actual names. You could also consider a recurring fictional brand to be a cadigan. The company Acme, for instance, is there are real companies called Acme, but the Warner Brothers cartoons, much to the dismay of Wile E. Coyote, use Acme as sort of an ironic, because it means the highest point, you know. So in an actual company name, it's a good thing, but in an ironic explodey coyote cartoon, then it's ironic.
Right. But rather than having to come up with a different brand name each time or to invoke a real brand name, they slap Acme on every product.
Exactly. And it also, it ends up being sort of a recurring joke, of course. Lorem ipsum text is technically a cadigan or placeholder name or placeholder text, right? It's a nonsense corrupted version of De Finibus Bonorum et Malorum, which was a first century text by Cicero.
Yeah. If you can read Latin, that does not mean you can read the lorem ipsum. It's gibberish.
Right. The lorem ipsum itself is a truncation of dolorem ipsum, which means pain itself.
Nice, huh?
We can also have numbers, placeholder numbers, like umpteen for the umpteenth time.
Oh, the nth degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've got placeholder locations, like Podunk is a town that exists in the middle of nowhere. And it comes from the name of the Native American Podunk people, interestingly, who lived in a marshy, remote area of Connecticut near what is now Hartford. In their language, Podunk means a place where you sink in mire. And the notion is just that it's very far, very hard to get to.
Right. So this is a bit, in another situation, someone might use Timbuktu.
Like, yeah, things like that.
Sort of just a generic distant place. Or in the olden days, they would talk about Guinea. It's just being in this sort of somewhere really, really blooming far away.
We have a bunch of names. We've talked about Alan Smithy before, who's the fake film director.
The name that you put in the credits if you don't want to be credited.
G.I. Joe was originally a name for your average American soldier before it was the name of the toy and the character.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
You got like Joe Schmo, John and Jane Doe, which we mentioned, John Q. Public, Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Here in Germany, if you look at say you want to apply for example, like a citizenship card or a residency card or whatever, and you know, they're showing you like a picture of what it's going to look like. The name that'll be on there, I can't remember the female version of it, but I think the male version it is Max Mustermann, usually, ooh, or something Mustermann, which means template man. The surname means that. So that's like Joe Bloggs.
Another way that you can maybe not fill a lexical gap, but you can invent a new word has been studied by psycholinguists. And have you heard of the WUG test?
No.
This shows that we can kind of put any syllable together to give a name to something. So researchers showed children a simple illustration of a non-specific creature that says, this is a WUG. It looks a little bit like a very basic illustration of a verb. And then you show two of those illustrations side by side and you say, there are two of them, there are two blanks. And the children had to answer with the answer, which would be wugs. So we have this notion that you're able to complete sentences using forms, even if the word is entirely new to you. So a man who zibs is blank, a zibber. So you have these unfamiliar pseudo words is what these are called that show that we internalize morphological features of language at a very young age, which I think is kind of cool. So you can create these words. Speaking of made up words, I think it would be fun to discuss word fugitives and sniglets, which I think we've mentioned before, but they're very fun to play with. Basically, when you create a word, especially a funny one for a concept that lacks a name, it can be called a word fugitive, so-called by Barbara Walriff of the Atlantic Monthly because they are wanted words, so to speak, or a sniglet, which was coined by Rich Hall. There are tons of examples of these. The notion behind Rich Hall's Sniglets, which debuted on the HBO series, not necessarily the news. They're created when you make up an intentionally humorous word for something with no existing word in the dictionary. And usually the definition makes the word funnier. Like dork with two O's is a person who pushes on a door marked pull, and lot shock is the act of parking your car, walking away, and then watching it roll past you.
Yeah, they're terribly whimsical, aren't they? Joke salt. When someone insults you, you call them out on it, and then they say, it was just a joke.
Right? Yes. Snackmosphere is the pocket of air found inside a potato chip bag. Aquadextrous is possessing the ability to turn the bathtub faucet on with your toes.
I love this.
I don't know why that has to do with toes necessarily, though.
Well, it doesn't actually, does it? But if you're not like actually up on the sort of proper etymology of ambidextrous, that is really, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, that's not sort of not the point, right? These don't hold, much like the bathtub in question, they don't really hold water necessarily, etymologically speaking, right? Like you've got an ice lanch, when ice at the bottom of an upturned glass suddenly moves toward the mouth as one attempts to finish drinking the liquid. We do need a term for that. We've all experienced it. It's an ice lanch, so an ice avalanche. I like these. Oh, what I also found when I was looking this up, though, so I think these were invented in like 1982, 84, somewhere around there, early 1980s, or at least the term sniglets was coined by Rich Hall. And there's this The Onion article from 2001 with the title, Man Won't Stop Coming Up With New Sniglets. This is true. Shall I read it? It's only four sentences long. Nearly 20 years after the briefly popular lexicographic fad made its debut on HBO's Not Necessarily the News, like Jess said, local resident Paul Appleby continues to create new sniglets. I was drinking coffee with Paul in the break room and he informs me that the non-dairy creamer residue at the bottom of the cup ought to be called the creamerass, co-worker Gail Farner said Monday. Then a few minutes later, he says, you know that little pop-up safety button on the cap of juice drinks? That's a snubbler. Added Farner, he's working on these things like there's still some place you can send them. Is that Rich Hall guy even still alive? Yes, Rich Hall is still alive. I think he's like 71, so he's not even that old. And he's still making us laugh over in Britain. He's quite popular in Britain, Rich Hall. Or at least he was 10 years ago.
There's also a similar game is a Daffy Nition, which I think was from the BBC Radio 4 comedy quiz show, I haven't a clue.
Yeah.
And those are, the definition is the funny part of that one because it twists
They're
a
words
real
that
word.
Already exist, right? Yeah. But you give them a different definition.
Like, decadent means possessing only 10 teeth.
I actually like these quite a lot more than the sniglets, because the sniglet you can basically do anything with, right? But these are those are clever. That was always my favorite round of I'm sorry, I haven't a clue.
Sniglets they're also just portmanteaus, right?
So a lot
like
of them.
My coworkers and I used to come up with these, and the few that I wrote down from back in the day were, which I'm sure other people have come up with before too, but one was serendipity, when you accidentally stumble into a witticism mid-sentence, and then optimization, when an error simplifies a process, and then blankruptcy, the point at which every intelligent thing you were planning to say leaves your mind entirely.
Oh, actually, I do like that. I need that word. Although I wouldn't be able to think of it when the moment came.
Oh, I like it. But more of the definitions were, this one's, you have to kind of break it down into, you have to re-bracket it yourself. So impolite is a flaming goblin, imp a light. Indistinct is where one places the dirty dishes in the sink.
Indistinct. Oh dear. No, that's weak. I don't like that one.
Information is how geese fly in formation.
Very good.
Innuendos is Italian suppositories. Innuendos.
Oh dear.
But there are tons of these. They're great.
There was a term that was very similar to sniglets that you mentioned.
Word fugitives?
Yeah.
Barbara Walruff coined that term in, I believe it was The Atlantic or The Atlantic Monthly. And for example, pandophonium is, I believe that's when you're anxious about your phone alarm going off.
And the thing is, these are only silly because they don't catch on, right? There must be in our language terms that have been created in much the same way that we still have. If they're created by the right sort of writer like Lewis Carroll or someone like that, then they might find their way and they might stay.
Oh yeah, of course. These are very much the same idea as his words that he created for Jabberwocky and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and other works like that.
Like portmanteau, indeed.
Yeah, like portmanteau. and like some of the words that have caught on unironically from those works, like chortle and galumph were originally these portmanteaus, and then we started using them normally.
We need a term for a sniglet that catches on.
Ooh.
Well, that's your homework. Come up with one of those. I think, have we done with this one, Jess?
Yeah, I think we can wrap up on that made up note.
I've enjoyed this one a lot, actually. It's been very silly.
It's been very fun. And we hope that you learned something and nothing today in the lexical gap field. I don't know.
There are no words to say how much I'm going to miss you until the next time we see you. Take care.
Better.